Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today, before I introduce our very special guest, we're going to watch a very quick video.
When someone tells you over and over again that you can't have what you want, you believe it. And those beliefs, unless they are interrupted, have the power to destroy your life. This book takes you on a journey of self-assessment, self-reflection, and self-empowerment, but it's not a quick fix. It's a playbook to a better life. And if you emulate my spiritual teachings, your life won't look the same 1 year from now. I want you to know that if you want something, you're meant to have it. That burning desire that you've always had is there for a reason. Your intuition tells you that you are supposed to do whatever you want to do, and that's why the burning desire never goes away. You may have shut it out a time or two in your lifetime, but it always comes back. Together, we're going to bring that burning desire to life. You can attract whatever you want, regardless of your past and present circumstances. When we're done with your spiritual transformation, those who have treated you badly will wish they hadn't. Miracles aren't reserved for the saints. We sinners are just as entitled to miracles, so let's go get yours.
Okay, wasn't that amazing? And now you're going to see the author herself, Paula Swope. She's an author, a Chopra certified instructor, and a life coach. Welcome, Paula Swope.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Well, I can't wait to talk after reading your book. Oh my God. So her book, as you saw, is called Thought Snob. Now you might wonder, well, what does that mean? Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. Yes, it's quite, took me a while to catch on. Maybe I was a little slow, but I think I finally got it. So anyway, you know, one of the things you said was in the intro or in the, you know, the part before the book, they said that your vulnerability is your superpower. And I'd have to agree with them that you really put yourself out there in this book. And, you know, you didn't, I don't think you hit anything. And that's what really made it so special, was that I'm sure that people, other people can relate to what you went through. So, So one of the comments you said at the beginning was that you were treated like you were nothing. Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about that? That was
sure.
Like from your childhood. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So there are many different types of adversity, and thinking back to when I was studying, like, you know, sociology in college, like I vaguely remember there were like six types of adversity. And one of the top ones was poverty. And so I just want to make this clear. I was not raised in poverty, like directly raised in poverty, like monetarily speaking, we did not live in poverty, but I was heavily influenced by people who were raised in very cruel poverty, very deep poverty, the type of poverty that people don't usually escape. And so my parents were raised in deep poverty, and their parents were, and it's just this big, you know, generation of poverty socialization. And so when you are raised, when you're impacted by poverty, either indirectly or directly, you share one commonality, and that is an expectation of defeat. And so when you have adopted that type of belief system, this, you know, expectation of defeat, then you're always expecting worst case scenario. And I remember doing that as young as, you know, 4 and 5 years old. I was worried over things at that age and shouldn't have been. It was ridiculous. And it's like just because,
yeah. Like, what were you worried about as a 4 and 5 year old?
Well, and what I'm getting to is why, you know, this led to me being treated like nothing. So, when I was in kindergarten, like, let's just say we took a field trip or something, I would be on the school bus, absolutely scared to death, just convinced that we were going to be getting into some type of a bus crash. And it's because I heard all of these gloom and doom conversations going around all the time. And it's just part of that rural landscape. It's like, it's embedded into the freaking culture. And every conversation is scary. And you're just fearful of everything. And a lot of that traces back to just never having enough of anything. And that is what I refer to when I say in my book that I was raised with I had a poverty invaded mindset. I mean, and I call it PIM, P-I-M. And my parents they did not intentionally do things to bring me down. Like, they really did, I think, want the best for me. They just didn't know any better. Like, they were doing what they had been taught to do, and they believed what they had been taught to believe, and they just passed all that trauma and all that fear onto me. And so I had these belief systems about myself, and they were all disempowering. And so I was operating as a kid, you know, we're talking about, you know, before my brain was fully developed, I mean, I thought that I was just less important than other people. Well, when you think that about yourself and you're operating unconsciously or subconsciously, then you migrate towards that. And so that's what led to me being treated like nothing. And it was this crazy cycle that went on inside of the home and outside of the home. And so there was a hierarchy in my house. And, you know, my father was at the top of that hierarchy, and I was, you know, way, way, way below where he was. And so there were a lot of highs and lows, you know, that went on there. And so sometimes I was on this pedestal. He would put me on this pedestal. And then other times he would just deliberately knock me off it. And at the time, I didn't know that I was dealing with a legit narcissistic personality. And they will treat you like you're nothing. And so that's where that comes from. And so enduring that from him and accepting that as my norm just led me to thinking that that's how everybody was. And it was normal to be treated like crap. And so I found myself being treated poorly by everybody in my world. And I just accepted it like, well, this is the way it is. So that's what I'm talking about in the book. And that's why I tell a lot of the stories that I tell, because I know how people feel and how they think when they're raised in that type of an environment. And so going into this book, I wanted to remove any barrier that anybody would have to getting the type of help that they need. And one of those barriers is intimidation. And so if they can relate to me and they can know that they aren't alone, and if I'm willing to admit all the things that I admit in this book, then they shouldn't be afraid to do it themselves. So that's why I say my vulnerability is my superpower, because it has helped people, a lot of people, just me being willing to tell my story and then link those stories to something that they can integrate into their daily lives has helped a whole lot of people. And so I just decided to just put it all into this book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's unbelievable, the story. But can I ask you a question about, I mean, being treated like you're nothing is part of it. Do you think, I'm just thinking that you can be treated like nothing with or without poverty, that's not mm-hmm. limited to the poverty mentality, because your father did make money. So they had the poverty mentality. They came from that. But I'm thinking that a lot of us probably felt like we were nothing, you know, just based on, I mean, you could look at anything. You could look at the models in the magazines and, you know, mm-hmm. all these standards that we measure ourselves by that we don't measure up. Now, I don't know, maybe that's a little different, but, you know, I'm thinking it's not limited to poverty.
Oh, it's absolutely not limited to poverty. Yeah. Absolutely not. Yeah. Everything associated with poverty is more relevant to someone like me who grew up in an environment like that, because it's rampant in the Appalachian region. It's rampant in these rural poverty pockets, all through the Appalachian region. And in that area, there's so many talented, hardworking people. But I was born in 1976, and the belief systems were absolutely archaic when I was growing up. You know, when I was being socialized in a rural area, women were just thought of being second-class citizens. And that's where a lot of that mistreatment comes from. And it was just very accepted for men to view women in a way that was just disempowering. You know, women were submissive to men. That's just the way it was. And men made the money and they were the breadwinners. So therefore they had all the control and all the power. And women just didn't. Growing up, I did not know, and I knew a lot of people, but growing up, I did not know one single family where the woman was the breadwinner. And so I sat back and observed all of that and just thought, well, I mean, I guess there's really no need of me even trying because I'm not capable of doing it. Mm. So those belief systems are, when they follow you into adulthood and they are not interrupted, they will absolutely wreck your world. And then you just go and you associate with people who believe like that. And then you just really get into quicksand. There's no movement. You're there. You're stagnant. That's it.
So, okay. So I know if you hold up the book again, you can get Paula's book. You can find it on Amazon. You look under Thought Snob and Paula Swope, Swope, and you can get the book. Now, how much of it can we talk about? I know you want them to read it. I'd like to ask you questions, but I had one guest and she was like, I can't answer that. Everything I asked her, she's like, they have to read the book. I'm not going to answer that. So I was like, okay, I don't want to get into that again. But I would like to ask you some questions, but I don't want to give away the whole story. So
sure. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we won't give it all away. I mean, it's 182 pages and there's a paperback and a Kindle, and then there's an audio book, and the audio book has 6 bonus stories that the actual book doesn't have. And my famous author friend who edited my manuscript, Alana Nash, that was her idea. She said, Paula, I swear to God, she said, these stories are so good. I mean, this is what people are really going to relate to and remember. And I can't fit them all in here. So why don't we, you know, use them as bonus stories in the audiobook? And I was like, you know what? That's a good idea.
So who recorded the audiobook? Did you?
Yeah. 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 So fun. Where I'm at here is in our podcast studio in our basement. And when my husband decided to set the studio up, he got a whisper room to do things like that. And that's where I record my guided meditations. And that's where I recorded my audio book. And he is the sound police. And so I wasn't allowed to have a chair. I stood for 3 days in that whisper room and I recorded that audiobook. And it was way more difficult than I would have ever imagined that it would be. And so I just heard it for the first time a couple of days ago. And it's really, really good. And for me to say that, it's a lot because I'm my toughest critic. But I'm so pleased with that audiobook. It's a whole other experience from the book itself. And so, but I ask away. I mean, well, I'll answer. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So it's hard. So I know, you know, you felt like nothing, blah, blah, blah. And then at some point you said you were 200 pounds and I forget the other, maybe you were drinking or something. You were with, you know, men who treated you like crap and stuff like that. When was that point? Like, I know you didn't go, right? You didn't go to, I know I ask a question that I keep talking. You didn't go to college right away, right? Because you figured, why bother? And, you know, whatever, because that was your mindset. So can you just say how that whole thing came about that you got to that?
Sure. So yeah, I dropped out of high school my junior year, and I had been like a 4.0 honor student from kindergarten all the way through high school. And my parents went through a really nasty divorce when I was in high school. And it just, I was right in the middle of that. And I used to say, you know, I've never been divorced, but I feel like, I mean, I've never been married, but I feel like I've been divorced because I was right in the middle of my parents' divorce. And it was brutal. It was brutal. And at, you know, looking back, I really, nobody talked about mental health. Nobody talked about that. And if somebody had a mental illness, then they were like a disgrace. They were something to be feared and ashamed of, or just, you know, cause it's crazy, you know, just written off as just being crazy. And so, but looking back, I was absolutely traumatized by everything that went on there. Because when my parents divorced, my mother and I left the home. And a week later, a new woman and her daughter moved in. And so that will tear somebody to pieces when they have
a week later. Wow.
A week later. And when you, I had no emotional intelligence at all. I was a teenager and a very immature one at that. And I just didn't know what to do with all of that. And so I went from a size 6 to a 16. I didn't even look like the same person in a very short period of time. And so I think that, and this is something I really want people to hear. If someone's appearance just absolutely changes like that, look out. Something is wrong. Something's wrong. And I think we've seen that in a lot of famous people. And so my whole appearance changed. I changed. And that's where all of that, you know, self-sabotaging behavior came from. It was all during that time.
Do you remember yourself eating to numb? Do you remember that? Or did you just all of a sudden find yourself?
I don't think I realized what I was doing. It was like unconscious self-sabotaging behavior. And during that time, I was just, I had adopted the belief that I was not lovable. Because when you are raised by a narcissistic person, it is one big mind game. And the one thing about narcissists is they have this list of favorites. And when you're number one on that list, you feel like the most invincible, most lovable, most special person in the world. But when they get bored with you and you're no longer feeding their ego properly and you're not giving them what they need and your purpose is kind of done, then they will replace you and they will do it unapologetically. They will not give you an explanation. If they do, then they're just going to make something up and cause a big fight and lead you to believe that you have caused them to no longer love you. And so that's what I was going through at that time. And so when this other child moved in that was pretty close to my age, she was, I think, 2 years younger than me, maybe. So we were pretty close in age. But when they moved in, she moved into my old bedroom and started answering to my nickname.
Oh.
And it was just really demented.
Did she look like you too?
She didn't. She didn't. She didn't look like me. That would have been even at a whole other level of like insanity. But that was too much for me to handle. And I just didn't realize. I did not realize how bad of a shape that I was in during that time. And so I absolutely let it get the best of me. And I went into it disempowered anyway. You know, I went into it with a lot of ridiculous beliefs about myself, and all of them, you know, could be traced back to this expectation of defeat, worst case scenario, gloom and doom, and that whole thing. And then that happens, and it just takes it to a whole other level. And so I really, you know, wallowed in that, and my weight kept going up, 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 up. And the binge drinking, like, it was just, that was what I did. I mean, I would binge drink and eat, and misery loves company. And so I had a whole crew of people who were there for my demise. They weren't doing any better either.
And that was after you dropped out of high school? So that's what you did? So,
well, I mean, I did some things in between. When I dropped out of high school, I mean, I got my high school diploma from a private school. I homeschooled the rest of my, I think it was my junior and senior year. But then I went to beauty school.
Oh.
And got my nail technician license and opened up a nail salon right in the middle of my self-sabotage journey. And that was a total joke. And I kept the business open, I think, for a year. And so, I mean, I was doing some things, but after the nail salon closed, then it was really, really downhill from there because I just didn't have any structure at all.
Mm.
And so I just really, truly just wallowed in hate. And all I did was drink and talk about how badly that the dad had treated my mother and I and all the bad stuff that was going on. It was just this woe is me pity party from daylight until dark. And the stories that I would tell were so outlandish that people were entertained by it and they were funny. And so it's all I talked about. And so when that's all you talk about and those the only feelings that you have are, you know, resentment and jealousy and revenge. I mean, I wanted revenge so bad that's the first thing I would think about in the mornings when I woke up. It's like, how can I get revenge against these people? I mean, it was just, I was obsessed with it. And again, it got the best of me. And I just attracted all of these horrible people, places, and things because that's the vibe that I was giving out. And I could not understand why my experiences were so bad. I just couldn't understand why everything I touched turned to shit. I couldn't understand. And it was me. It was me that was doing it. And so there's power in how we think and power and how we feel and power and how we talk. And when I learned about all of that through Dr. Wayne Dyer, it was like a new kind of fear at that point because I thought, oh God, I can't believe that something irreversible didn't happen to me during all of those years. Hell, I did enough damage. But it was damage that actually could be cleaned up, and I cleaned it up. But I'm really actually surprised that something irreversible didn't happen.
So what was the moment, if you don't mind saying it, there you are, you know, what was me? All you want is revenge, hate, drinking, weight. What was the moment? Was there a moment when, I mean, because a lot of people would never get out of that. They would never wake up to, oh, you know what I mean? Like, what do you attribute it to that you turned your life around?
I really, really got sick of being controlled. And really, really sick of being manipulated. And I'd gotten myself into a situation with Dad where I relied on him for all of my resources. And there were a couple of reasons that I did that. Number one, he really led me to believe that I was not capable of making it on my own, doing anything on my own. And then the second was that revenge piece of it. You know, I was like, okay, if he's going to shower all of these, you know, these women with diamonds and Rolexes and these luxury cars, then I need some compensation for, you know, my pain and suffering. And so I belittled myself and hung in there to get what I could, because my mediocre brain at that time thought that, you know, that's what I was supposed to do. That's how I was going to balance the books. No, that was absolutely ridiculous. And so there was a situation, and it was when I was in graduate school.
So I was
pretty fed up. Oh, go ahead.
But you went from, like, when did, because in the book, and maybe I missed it, all of a sudden you had your college degree and you were in grad school. Like, how did that even happen if you were in such a rut? How did you get yourself there?
That was kind of odd, because I just seriously, it was like inspired action, because there was no logic behind that decision. I was sitting at the bar at my friend's house, and I was 24 or 25. I had probably turned 25, and I had started losing the weight. I mean, something had clicked, and I was like, I've got to do something. And I was sitting with my friend at the bar, and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to go to college. You know, I was always really good at school, and I think I'm going to go to college. And she was like, what? And I said, I just really feel compelled to do this. And I asked her, I said, would you take me and drop me off on EKU's campus tomorrow? And she said, yeah, Paula. I said, thanks. So she dropped me off on campus, and I went to the admissions office, and I had never been online before. And I went into the admissions office, and the student workers in there looked at me like I was insane when I said, well, I don't know how to get online. I mean, I don't know how to do that. And they did it for me, and I enrolled and started classes the next week. And nobody thought that I would finish college, much, much less graduate with honors. Mm. And then go all the way, you know, and get my master's degree. But that was a real pivotal moment. And to this day, I don't know where that came from. I was really unhappy. I was really sick of the party scene. I was wanting a change. I've always loved change. I embrace change. I make a lot of life-changing decisions once every 4 or 5 years. Anybody that knows me personally knows that I do that, probably more than anybody else I know. But during that time, it just really happened out of the blue, and people really discouraged that and made fun of me for doing it. And I didn't have any support at at all, really. And dad contributed financially to my tuition because it's like the squeaking wheel gets the grease kind of thing. I mean, I would not let that go. And so, but yeah, it was just really out of the blue. And I really think I've thought about that more than once. Where did that come from?
What did you study?
But that's how it happened.
Yeah. What did you study? What did you pick as a major?
My bachelor's is in political science, and I chose that major to get out of difficult math classes. That was it.
Hey.
Yeah. And okay. I thought, you know, I was really intrigued by politics at the time. Mm-hmm. At the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was different. It was a different climate. But and I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll run for public office one day, but that never happened, and that really wasn't something that inspired me for too long. But I got the bachelor's in political science, and then that led me to a master's in public administration.
Hmm.
And that master's degree took me far. I was able to do a lot with that degree. The political science degree, not so much.
So, all right, we're going to go to our commercial break, and then we're going to find out what happened after that. But this is such a great story. All right, thank you. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to have your kids have more fun, be more social, be more connected, then bring Kikori to your schools, to your businesses, to your teams. It's really fun, as the commercial said. It's more fun than recess. And you can go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a consultation. And then, let's see, I think today I'm going to promote of my books, not the one in the commercial, but this one. This is my story, the second piece of French toast. If marriage was my dream, why was I numbing myself? So I can definitely relate to Paula and what she was going through or what she was doing. And if you haven't bought that, it's a great story. You're not allowed to judge me, but it also leaves me a bit vulnerable. You can find that on Amazon.com, Hillary A. Burns or Arno Burns or Hillary Burns, the second piece of French toast. It's a great story. Especially if you're in a marriage and you didn't know how you got to where you're at. All right. And now we will bring back Paula Swope and hear the rest of the story. Okay, so you got your master's. Now, would you say that you had had your like Wayne Dyer moment yet, where you were just kind of going along, going to school and stuff like that? Would you say, you know, you still had the Appalachian mentality, or had you seen something different at that point?
I was about 28 or 29 when I got a big wake-up call, and I started questioning the things that I had been taught to believe about myself. And it started with a Wayne Dyer book. And I've gone back and forth over how that book landed in my lap. And I can't remember if I bought it or somebody gave it to me, but I think I had a friend that gave it to me. Mm-hmm. And the first two Wayne Dyer books that I read, Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life, and then The Power of Intention, I read those books. And then I saw him on PBS because Dr. Dyer used to do lectures on public television on PBS all the time. It's funny. Those are my initials. And then I watched him speak, and I swear to God, Hillary, nobody had ever made any sense to me up until then. And I had been heavily influenced by organized religion. And I've always believed in God. My faith is stout in God, but not in organized religion. Mm-hmm. And I even rejected that at a really, really young age. It's just something just didn't quite feel right about that. And so when I listened to Wayne Dyer speak, and he pitched God to me in a totally different way, like I had never heard before, I was like, oh my God, this is like the answer. Like this is the answer. And I remember him saying, hostile people live in a hostile world. Loving people live in a loving world, same world. And when I heard that, I was like, huh, I'm definitely in a hostile world. How do I get over here to this other side? And I started people watching. And if you people watch, that's all the evidence you need in the differences between lifestyles. That's all you need. Because why is it that one person is stuck in poverty their entire life and they're sick and they're unhappy, when the next person who might have been born into the exact same circumstances, their life is totally different. It's prosperous and it's fruitful and it's loving and the relationships are healthy and they aren't toxic. But then you've got somebody else who, you know, their entire life is just a disaster. And that is not a coincidence at all. And so that was when I really started to see things differently. And it really did start with a mindset shift. And so Dr. Dyer led me to all the greats. Mm. And one evening, because I removed myself from my crew a little bit, and I stopped hanging in the bars so much. And in the evenings, I would go to Hastings, which was a bookstore that was just a couple of miles from my house. And I remember going into Hastings and finding a book by Louise Hay, You Can Heal Your Life. And she's, you know, for people who are watching and listening, if they don't know who Louise Hay is, she's our, you know, our queen of positive affirmations. And I bought her book and I still have it. Like I still have the book and it's just marked up all over the place. I mean, I just ripped it up, just writing all over it. And she introduced some positive affirmations to me. And that was a new concept. I'd never, ever used any positive affirmations, no mantras, nothing like that. No positive self-talk. It was just foreign concepts to me, period. And so I was so incredibly broke at that time, financially speaking. And at that time, I thought, well, if I could just get some money, you know, I could get out of this, you know, get out from underneath dad's control and out from underneath his fingernail. And I could, you know, help mom, and I could get on my own. I could just do all this stuff. And I remember reading her whole book, and she said, use a positive affirmation for whatever problem that you've got. You know, think about what you don't want, turn it into what you do want, and then find a positive affirmation for it. So I landed on, I'm wealthy. And I remember going to the bathroom one morning and looking in the mirror and saying, I'm wealthy. And it was like everything in my body rejected that, but I kept saying it. I kept saying it, and I would write it down. I would write it down until my arm was sore. I'm wealthy. I'm wealthy. I'm wealthy. And I just started focusing on that. And in the beginning, I didn't believe what I was saying at all. But then I woke up one morning and I did believe it. And when I started to believe it, things really started to change. My situation started to change. But I mean, I had to go through absolute turmoil to get out of that hostile world into the loving world, because these toxic people do not go silently in the night. And when you dig a hole so deep, I mean, it can take a long time to crawl out of that. And that's what I had done. And so in my book, in the seventh chapter, I talk about this. And I call it a universal uprooting, because when you decide that you want a better life for yourself, people got to go. Situations got to go. Jobs got to go. Everything has to go to get you to where you're supposed to be. And so my whole world was uprooted in a very shocking kind of way. And everything changed. Everything that had made up my identity into that point had to go. And it was a really, really difficult time. But once I got past that, I actually saw that, you know, life was actually really kind of great. And everybody wasn't an asshole. And there were nice, honest people out there. And money really wasn't that hard to come by. And you know what? I'm not some, you know, frail victim here. And so it was all a mindset shift, all of it. And back to what you asked me, what feels like 8 hours ago, it was in my late 20s. When all that started clicking. But it took a long time. It took a long time to get me evened out and leveled out and to find some balance. It took a few years. And I also had to go on a big forgiveness journey too. And that was, I would say, probably the most difficult but most beneficial piece of that time frame, from, I'm going to say, 28 to 29 years old up into about 35, 36.
Wow. And when what kind of work were you doing? And when did you meet your husband and stuff? Which part of that? Was that during that? Was that after that?
It was during that. And so I the master's degree, the master's of public administration, It led me to grant writing. And I'm going to tell you something right now, that's the most stressful profession in the world. And it's not like anybody ever wakes up and says, oh my God, I want to be a grant writer. Nobody does that. And either you're good at it or you're not. And it's really very difficult. Well, I was given an opportunity in graduate school to write a grant. And it was something that the college was working on. Well, the university, Eastern Kentucky University, was working on, and they called on some graduate students to help out with this grant. And I ended up doing it, and the grant was funded. And I just had a knack for it, and for whatever reason, enjoyed the work. And that led me to working with EKU, my college, my university, for a few years. And what I did during that time was I went into school districts in poverty pockets in Kentucky. And I did fundraising to bring money in to pay for programs and services that these kids, students needed in these schools that just didn't have any money. I mean, there's no money. And so that's what I did for a while. And then I got a job offer from a very, world-renowned, prestigious institution of education at Berea College. And I took this position at Berea College, and that's where I really honed those grant writing skills and had an opportunity to work on some of the largest federal grants out there. I was part of the Gear Up Grant, Gaining Early Awareness and Readiness in Undergraduate Programs. That is the largest federally funded educational initiative in history. It came about in 1999. Berea College had that grant since its inception. And so I had an opportunity to work on those grants and many other very large federal grants. And so I got a lot of experience. And when I was a few years into that job, I worked with some of the most wonderful people ever, traveled to some of the greatest places, huge opportunities, but they didn't want to pay me anything. Right. And there was no moving up. Like I had moved up, but I was never going to make any more money. And it was a micromanaged atmosphere too. And you cannot fence somebody like me in. If you stick me behind a desk and tell me I got to sit there for 8 hours, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to have the motivation of an inmate on death row. It's just not going to work out for anybody. And so I found myself in a position where I was ready to make another big life-changing decision. And when I was 35, I met my husband, Will. And I was just, living alone with my little dog, Presley. And my friend David was working for my husband at the time and introduced the two of us. And I had been envisioning a healthy relationship. I had been envisioning being with somebody kind and supportive and just normal and healthy. And that was just the opposite of any man I had ever known or been involved with, intimately or platonic, family, whatever. So what I was seeing in my mind was, I cannot stress to you enough, the opposite of anything I had known. And so when I met Will, I knew within 30 minutes that he was different and different in a good way. And so we started seeing each other and never parted. And we had been seeing each other for a few months, I think, trying to do the math here. Been seeing each other for a few months, and I was complaining about being unhappy in my job. And was talking about how I wanted to branch off and start my own business. And neither one of us had any money at that time. And Will said, I want you to watch this speech. And it was Jim Carrey's 2014 commencement speech at the Maharishi International University, which I ended up taking classes at a year or so after that. And so I watched this speech, and you can find it on YouTube. And I watched that speech, and I literally got up and sent in my resignation to that job. And I had given, 2 weeks notice. And after that 2 weeks was up, I went out on my own as an independent consultant. I left the W-2 world, never went back. And within about a year, 2 years, I had doubled my salary working as an independent consultant in the grant writing world. Wow. And made quite a name for myself in the nonprofit world. My portfolio says I raised $60 million. And so I did that until May of 2021. And in May of 2021, I just lost my mind and said, you know what? I'm going to resign from this career. I've had a remarkable run, and I'm going to do what I really, really want to do. And that's what I'm doing right now.
Mm. So that was 3 years ago. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
What a story. All right. One last question. And again, hold up your book again. We want you to read the rest of her story because it's amazing. There's other stories that you've not heard. It's Thought Stop by Paula Swope. You can find it on Amazon. One of the things you had talked about was your, not to be personal, but it is in the book, your urinary what was that called? Like cystitis, which is
interstitial cystitis.
And you had it for how many years? Like
The urinary issues started, the bladder issues started when I was about 18. And I thought it was urinary tract infections because that's what most people think when they have IC and it's not diagnosed. And so I just dealt with that for many, many years. And I was seeing a urologist who was clueless, and he just kept prescribing me Cipro. So, well, just take this when you, you know, feel a UTI coming on. So I was taking all this Cipro, and then I found a doctor because it kept getting worse. I mean, you know, the pain kept getting worse, and anything acidic made it 10 times worse. And so I found a urologist that had some sense, and he said, well, Paula, he said, I can't believe that no one has told you this up until now, but your textbook, I see, I mean, it's, that's what you've got. And there's no cure, and you're just going to have to live with it, but you can make some lifestyle changes, and it will never really get better, but you might be able to keep the flares at bay, because that's what we call it, a flare, when you're in fetal position and you feel like your whole pelvic area is on fire. Ugh. And then when you, you know, pee, it can feel like razor blades. When you have a really, really bad flare. And so I was diagnosed with, I got the official diagnosis in 2016 or 2017. And I was like, okay, all right. You know, this is not going to debilitate me. I'll make the lifestyle changes and I'll, you know, get a handle on this. Well, when I started digging into IC, I realized that I had absolutely manifested that condition, and it had been caused by years and years and years of chronic stress that had not been interrupted. And when that happens, then your physiology becomes absolutely infiltrated with inflammation, and inflammation is at the root cause of every disease known to man. And so I had so much inflammation in my body from all of that abuse that I had endured and harboring all of those, you know, just really low frequency emotions. And I, even in Louise Hay's book, You Can Heal Your Life, she talks about bladder issues being linked to bitterness and anger and hostility. And that's what happened to me. That's why I got IC. There's no doubt in my mind. So,
wow.
I started.
So let me, I'm going to interrupt now because they're going to have to read the book to find out the rest, because it's time to wrap up, believe it or not. Yeah.
That went fast.
I know. So again, Paula Swope, Thought Snob, find it on Amazon. And what, let's say, you know, I know you've had such a transformation, right? I mean, her younger years are, it's like she's two different people. You know, when I was reading it, I was like, look at her. That couldn't have been her. But anyway, but it was. So how, let's say people read the book, they got this, they got, you know, all the stuff you learned from Rain Dyer and all the other books. I know you had promoted them in your book. How do you see the world, or what's your vision for making a difference?
It's a big vision. So what I know, without a shadow of a doubt, is if everybody in this world could adopt an empowering belief system about themselves, and if they could do something every single day to interrupt chronic stress and release inflammation from their body, and if they could practice forgiveness in the way that it's supposed to be practiced, and start seeing themselves with a little bit more compassion, and start seeing other people with a little bit more compassion, then most of our problems in this world, and I'm talking about the problems that have gone on since the beginning of time, would absolutely subside. Because there's not one policy that's going to fix it. There's not enough money that can fix it. It's going to take people changing their mind about the world and the role that they have in it. And that's my big vision.
Mm. And if that happened, then what?
Well, I don't think that there would be so much hate. The hate is heavy. And if you take a look at the health statistics in certain parts of the world, take Appalachia, for example, the disease rates are astronomical. Chronic disease, astronomical. There wouldn't be any chronic disease if people would practice these concepts that help them to keep their parasympathetic nervous systems turned up and that sympathetic nervous system turned down. And so that way their whole life is just about releasing that inflammation and feeling good. And there wouldn't be all of these early mortality rates and high cancer rates and diabetes, and there certainly wouldn't be as much violence.
Mm.
And so if we could nail those two things, hey, we'd be living in a near perfect world.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for writing the book. Thank you for doing the work. And thank you for who you've become, that you can share yourself with the world. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. And thank you. I can't wait to read your book. I know you've got three.
Yes, that's right. No judging. Remember, no judging.
Oh, no. These are no judgment zones right here. You can't judge us. Uh-uh. No, you got to learn from it. You can't judge us. No.
That's right. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony, and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.